the lightning bolt. If you would, as we begin tonight, go ahead and grab your Bibles. Open them up to 1 Samuel chapter 25. If I'm correct in my Bible reading, we're in one of my favorite spots in the Bible, one of my favorite stories as a young kid growing up, and even today, someone that I feel like we can look up to and learn a whole lot from. But by way of introduction, as I was reading this week's Bible lesson, getting ready, making sure that I knew what I wanted to talk about, hopefully, I came across chapter 25, and I read through it, and I couldn't help but think of a fairy tale. Everybody loves a good fairy tale, right? I mean, who doesn't like to be the hero, the handsome prince, who goes riding into battle to fight the dragon or the evil armies, to save the beautiful damsel in distress, and to take her home and to live, the famous words, happily ever after, right? My favorite fairy tale happens to be a cartoon movie. It's called Shrek. Most of you may not have seen this. I know the kids down here have seen it. It literally has everything you could ever want in a fairy tale in it. You know, it starts off with the ugly ogre wanting to control his swamp. All he wants is his swamp. He wants his privacy. He wants to be there by himself. And I can sympathize with that a lot because as a little kid, I love to just close the door in my room and be completely by myself. So I know where he's coming from on this. He wants the swamp, but to be able to get the swamp, he has to go on a mission for the king. He has to go and save the lady, the princess, from the tower. So he goes to do that and to bring her back with his talking donkey. It's really a strange story, but it makes me laugh. And as they're bringing the woman back, you know, they run into all kinds of problems because she happens to be in a tower surrounded by lava, guarded by a dragon, and they encounter problems all the way back. And it turns out that the princess is hiding something, that at night when the sun goes down, she too turns into an ogre, which is really one of the strange twists of the story that if you hadn't already seen it, you wouldn't see it coming. And it turns out that, you know, along the way, he's meeting all these other different characters from fairy tales, which is really cool. That's how it's all kind of in one big thing. But most importantly of all, as with all fairy tales, it has its happy ending, because in the end, Shrek the ugly ogre finally gets to marry the beautiful princess ogre that he rescued from the castle. I mean, it really is a beautiful scene as he comes charging in at the end of the movie, you know, hero's welcome, not hero's welcome, but in hero fashion as he crashes the party and says, "Fiona, I love you, I want you to be my wife," and, you know, they get together. And isn't that what we all want in life, is a happy ending? You know, no matter what's going on in our lives, especially when we get to that end of day when we all die, we want to say that we have a happy ending in our lives. But also when it comes to settling our disagreements, when we don't agree with each other, when we have arguments, you know, whether it be with our brothers and sisters, our husbands and wives. I know husbands and wives don't ever argue, do they? Whether it be with somebody sitting across the aisle from you tonight, I don't know. We want happy endings. We plan for happy endings. We want things to go just right so that everything can be fixed, don't we? How often do we manage those happy endings, though? I know, for my part, probably not as much as I would like. I don't always end up with the perfect scenario, perfect situation at the end of an argument, at the end of a disagreement. It doesn't always go my way, and that's just the way it is. Most of the time, I think we manage to mess it up, especially when we're having our disagreements. You know, I may be mad at you, but I don't really want you to know that I'm mad at you, right? So we avoid each other, don't we? We avoid being within about the same 10-foot radius of each other. We don't make eye contact. When that person walks into the room, we turn around and we walk the other way. We try to avoid the situation in the best that we can. Sometimes we play dumb, don't we? Like, problem? I didn't know there was a problem. You're mad at me? No way. That's one of my favorites. I'm good at that one. A lot of times we try to act like there is nothing wrong at all. You know, I may be mad at you, but we're going to go on with life and everything is going to be great. We're not ever going to talk about it. We're not ever going to sit down and try to discuss it. We're just going to go on. And it's that can really get ugly, isn't it? That can kind of boil, it can cause a whole lot of problems if we don't take care of it. And as we pick up tonight's story here in chapter 25, we come in verse 3, well, not actually in verse 3, but we come in a story. It's probably an ordinary day gone wrong, I think is the best way to sum it up. That happy ending to the day that we all want about 8 o'clock in the morning is just gone out the window. You know how it is. You wake up and it's just over. But we come across a young lady named Abigail. She's going about her daily chores, taking care of business, as we like to say. She happens to be the wife of a very rich man back in those days. He possessed 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. If that's not rich, I don't know what is. And being the wife of a rich man, she is in charge of the house and everything that goes on inside of it. They live in a land called Maon, in the wilderness of Paran. And I looked on maps, and they don't really show you where that is. They don't really show you where Carmel is. The best I can tell you is that it is south of Hebron, where Saul reigns. It is south of Jerusalem, where David eventually reigns. It is down there, way far south, where the Red Sea kind of makes a Y. She's married to a man, like we talked about. His name is Nabal. And he's described to us in verse 3 as mean and surly. If you skip on down to verse 17, one of his own servants calls him worthless. And even a few verses later, in verse 25, his own wife says that he lives up to his name, which is a fool. Nabal was not a very good character, not a very good guy, probably not somebody that you would want to be married to. But Nabal got lucky, and I think it was probably just because of an arranged marriage. But he is married to Abigail, who is beautiful. Verse 3 tells us that she is good-looking and that she's clever. Can you imagine a better combination than a wife? Somebody who is beautiful and somebody who is smarter than you. I like that. But here we find Abigail. She's going about making sure everything is in order, making sure that there is enough food and water and provisions to take care of all the people who are shearing the sheep, because you see, it is sheep shearing time in the wilderness of Paran. Say that 10 times fast. Sheep shearing time, and all the people are gathered together. They have a bunch of people to feed right now and to take care of, so she's making sure that everything is going right with that. And then in verse 14... something probably a little bit strange, a little bit out of the ordinary happens. She sees one of her servants running towards her. And as the woman of the house, this would probably get your guard up as, oh no, what's going on? Something is wrong. And so here the servant comes. She says, what's wrong? Tell me about it. And he begins to tell her a story, a very interesting story, probably about verse 14. Her husband, it turns out, has insulted David. This was not just any ordinary David that you might run across and meet on the street. This was David the warrior. David who had just killed a giant. David who had songs written about him where Saul had slain his thousands, but David his 10,000s. This is not a guy that you want to make angry, is it? David, you see, had been running at this point for probably a little bit over a year. He had been running from Saul, who was trying to kill him. And as the story goes, he's making his way further and further south from Hebron. And here he finds himself in the wilderness. He now has a following of about 600 men. And they spent probably close to the year, here guarding Nabal's wealth, taking care of all of his sheep, all of his goats, all of his servants, all of the stuff that made Nabal a rich man. Taking care of it. Doing such a good job that we read one of the servants, or the servant as he's describing all this, says that they were a wall around us. We didn't lose anything. You know, not one sheep, not one goat. Nothing went missing while David was protecting us. David did a good job. He was good at what he did. And when he hears that it's sheep shearing time, he sends 10 of his best men down to meet with Nabal and say, and he says, "Nabal, you know, we did all of this good work for you. Could you help us out? You know, we need a little bit of payment." This was kind of the customary thing. There would be people who would protect your wealth, especially as it's out in the wilderness and very vulnerable to attack. And when it came time to shear those sheep and to get your profits and to make all of your money, you would send a little food, send a little money that person's way. And that's all David is expecting out of here. It was the custom. And as the servants ride up and they meet Nabal, they tell Nabal, "You know, we protected all of your stuff. Could you help us out?" Nabal refuses. He says, "No, I'm not going to do that." He says, "Who is David? There's lots of servants who have ran away from their masters and are running around, you know, doing whatever today. I'm not going to do it. Why? Why should I give up everything that I made for David?" A very self-centered attitude, I think. But who is David? Hey, I don't even know how he could ask this question. But he does. And he sends the servants away with absolutely nothing. And as they come to David, they tell David everything that went on. How do you think David reacted? How would you react? If somebody had just insulted your character like that, how would you react? Probably not well. Now, most of us are not lucky enough to have 600 warriors following us, though. Because as David hears this, he gets madder and madder and madder. And finally, he says, "Grab your swords, boys. We're going to war." He straps on his sword, takes 400 men with him. 400. He didn't even take them all. He takes 400 men after this one guy and is going to kill him. As Abigail is listening to this story, you can almost hear the wheels turning in her head, can't you? Because women have that ability. They think a lot further ahead and a lot quicker than men do, for whatever reason. But you can hear those wheels as she's going, "Man, what am I going to do? How am I going to fix this? How am I going to keep from being killed myself?" And verse 18 is her solution, if you would just read there with me. It says that Abigail quickly gathered 200 loaves of bread, 2 leather bags full of wine, 5 roasted sheep, 2 bushels of roasted grain, 100 bunches of raisins, and 200 cakes of dried figs, and loaded them onto donkeys. And she said to her servants, "You go on ahead and I will follow." But she said nothing to her husband. If that's not fast thinking, I don't know what is. She did a good job. She came up with an excellent plan. But check out verse 20. That as she was riding her donkey around a bend on a hillside, when she suddenly met David and his men coming toward her. This is a very interesting picture. I don't know if you can see this or not. But here is David and his 400 men in all of their armor, with all of their shields, with all of their swords, on all of their horses, probably riding as fast as they possibly could towards Nabal's house. And here comes Abigail on a donkey with a handful of servants. If that's not like the setup for a battle of all time, I don't know what it is. And it seems a little bit silly, but if we look at it a little bit closer, I think what we have here is a showdown of two completely different ways of being in this world. Two completely different outlooks on life. Because you see, David was a warrior. He was desperate to save his image at this point because it had been completely insulted. His problem-solving skills revolved around military force, revolved around how strong he was and how he can bring you into submission. Abigail, on the other hand, is a wife desperate to save her home. And as head of this household, she had to have been able to develop the skills to peacefully resolve conflict, hadn't she? Because you can't exist in a house that large, take care of that many people, if everybody is always fighting, can you? It doesn't work that way. It just doesn't work well. David's instinct was to fight, and Abigail's was to seek peace. And as she comes to David there in verse 23, we see that she does something probably completely unexpected to David. I can almost imagine, you know, as he draws his horse to a stop, the shock on his face. It says that when Abigail saw David, she quickly dismounted and threw herself on the ground at David's feet and said to him, "Please, sir, listen to me." She hops off her donkey and onto the ground and on her knees, where she proceeds to beg an audience with David and to completely take the blame for everything. Can you imagine that? It's not even her fault. She didn't even know it had happened till the servant came to her. But as she rides towards David, the only thing she can think of is, "Lay this blame on me. It's my fault because I wasn't there." She talks about her husband and how he lives up to his name, that Nabal is a fool. Nabal was an idiot for the things that he did to you. She continues in her speech calling David Lord no less than 8 times. Can you imagine David as he sits on his horse at this point? I mean, just completely in shock, completely in awe, and maybe even a little bit of wonder at this woman and everything that she was doing right now. She reminds David of God's promise in verse 30. It's there that she says, "And when the Lord has done all the good things he has promised you and has made you king of Israel, then you will not have to feel regret or remorse, sir, for having killed without cause or for having taken your own revenge. And when the Lord has blessed you, sir, please do not forget me." She reminds David, she says, "David, you're going to be king. You are going to rule it all one day. Don't ruin it on this one fool. Don't take all your anger out on this one guy who doesn't know what he's doing." Notice David's complete and intense reaction in verse 32. It says that David said to her, "Praise the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you today to meet me. Thank God for your good sense and for what you have done today in keeping me from the crime of murder and taking my own revenge." This woman, this beautiful, clever, homemaking woman, was able to disarm 400 heavily armed soldiers in just a few words, with just a few actions. And I think that that is absolutely incredible. In this story, I believe we see two ways of dealing with our problems, of dealing with our anger. We see David's way. David reacts in power. You know, he approaches things from his background. He's very reactionary. It's one of those knee-jerk reactions where I'm insulted, all right, I'm going to go take care of business. We see Abigail as she comes to the situation with a completely different mindset, and she acts with grace from her background. There are all kinds of lessons in this story. But tonight I want to focus on how we handle our problems, on how we deal with the disagreements that come along in our lives. How do we settle our fights? Do we react like David, or do we act like Abigail? As readers of this story, as third-party readers to this story, we sit there going, "David, what are you doing, man? You know better than that. After all that God has done for you, after everything that you've seen God do, after you've been able to protect your father's sheep, after you killed Goliath the giant, after you just got done the chapter before sparing Saul's life in the cave of Adullam, how could you do such a stupid thing?" Especially when we find that God calls David a man after his own heart. How could he do such a thing? But I believe that's the beauty of Scripture, is that God doesn't ask us to be absolutely perfect, does he? He asks us to do the best that we can. Because how many of us react like David? Honestly, if we're honest with ourselves, when stuff goes on, we often become very reactionary. I know that I would. If that had been me in that situation, I probably would have taken all 600 men and tried to pick up a few more on the way. And as readers, I think it's easy for us to feel sorry for Abigail, isn't it? Because here she is in this terrible situation. You know, not only is she in a really bad marriage with a man whose name is a fool, but he has also put her in a very, very bad situation where he's going to die and David's probably going to kill everybody that's there, including her. It's easy to feel sorry, but honestly, I don't think that we should. She knew why she was there. She knew why she had been where she was. She knew her purpose in life. She had been sent by God. God put her there. And I believe God put her there for this very purpose, to take care of this problem. You know, as Christians, we're sent by God. And because of that, we have to be careful in how we handle things and how we deal with our problems and how we deal with the difficulties in our lives. When it comes to resolving our issues, I believe, number one, we have to act. We see it in both examples. David takes action immediately, doesn't he? He doesn't wait around for, 7 to 10 days and then go after him. I mean, he gets up, puts his sword on, and goes to it. Abigail, when she hears about it, she gets up and she gets busy. She gets all the food together and then is gone. She's gone so fast she doesn't even tell her own husband where she's going, does she? They act. You know, we can't afford to sit around and wait. When something goes wrong, when we have a disagreement, we can't sit around to act. And I think Joe talked about that this morning. I took a CPR class a couple of weeks ago. I don't know that I could really save anybody's life, but I took the class. And one of the things that they talked about was in an accident situation, when you come across an accident, that a lot of people will just drive by. You know, they won't stop, they won't offer any help, that they just drive by. They don't even bother to call 911 because they think somebody else has already done it. We can't sit back and assume that someone else will take care of it. We've got to be on top of things. We've got to take care of it as fast as we possibly can. What makes the difference, though, as we act, I think, is how we act. Do we act in anger like David did? Or do we act in grace like Abigail? I propose to you tonight that we take Abigail's plan of action. Because, you see, she did a number of things that I think can be very helpful as we deal with things. You see, Abigail humbles herself. She's the wife of a rich man. She's a very important lady as far as things go in the Old Testament times. But she is able to be on her knees begging forgiveness, isn't she? She humbles herself. We've got to be humble. It's not easy to get down on our knees, is it? It's not easy to be a humble person. I know I struggle with it quite a bit. But not only did she humble herself, because she could have stood up to David, probably wouldn't have gone over as well, would it? And when it comes to settling an argument, standing up to someone is probably not the best way to do it. But not only did she humble herself, she took the blame. She says, I want you to put this on me. Blame me. It is my fault. Don't blame my worthless husband. How many of us are willing to do that? Even if it's not our fault, even if we didn't do it, it's really hard to take that blame. But that's one of the most important things I think that we can do as we're resolving our issues, is to just say, you know what? It's my fault. I'm sorry. I'm sorry I shouldn't have done what I did. Humbling ourselves, taking the blame. But she also does something else that's very important. She builds David up. doesn't she? Ladies are very good at this, about buttering guys up, making you feel good about yourself, right? And it works, doesn't it? You know, we talked about it. She uses the word Lord no less than 8 times in those short, it's 5 or 6 verses. She builds him up. And guys, if you want to win an argument, if you want to settle a fight, the best thing that you can possibly do is to build that other person up, to help make them feel good about themselves. And not only does she build David up, she also reassures him. She says, you know, you are fighting God's battles. God is going to make you king. God is going to take care of all of your enemies. That way, when you are king, you can have a clear conscience before him. I think that's one of the great things that we see played out, even as Saul and Jonathan are dead, is that David has a clear conscience before all of the people, and more importantly, before God. And as a result of these 4 things, Abigail is blessed. David sends her away, thankfully, you know, thanking God for sending her to him, sends her away with the blessings. And here we find, in starting in verse 36, her happy ending. It says that Abigail went back to Nabal, who was at home having a feast fit for a king. He was drunk and in a good mood, so she did not tell him anything until the next morning. Then after he had sobered up, she told him everything. He suffered a stroke and was completely paralyzed. Some 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. It's one of those interesting passages. It's translated a bunch of different ways. Whether it was a stroke, whether it was a heart attack, we don't really know what it was. But Nabal ended up in bed for 10 days before he died. Can you imagine having to sit there for 10 days thinking about what you did to get you in the position where you are? You've got 10 days to think about it before God dies. But this is Abigail's happy ending, because as her husband dies, David hears about it and comes, and she becomes David's most intelligent wife, I believe. How are we at resolving our conflicts? If most of us are like I think we are, we're probably not very good. I know I'm sure not. I pray tonight that we can take Abigail's example, that we can be able to humble ourselves, that we can be able to shoulder the blame even when it's not our own, that we can learn to build others up, because encouragement is what it takes to be able to reassure people, to be able to reassure people that God has a plan for you, that God is going to take care of you. I hope that this is something we can put into practice in our lives, something that will be very practical for us. Just think of the blessings that God has given you. Think of the blessings that God will continue to give you if we can honor him, if we can settle our conflicts, settle our differences in godly ways. Tonight, if you have unresolved conflict in your life, I hope that you'll take care of it. Don't let it go on for another hour. If you need prayers for the strength to do it, we're here for you tonight. If you need to be baptized and simply resolve the conflict of sin in your life, I can't think of a happier beginning to any story. If there's anything we can do for you tonight, please come as we stand and sing.